Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Well, it's our favorite time of the day again with Counter Stories for people of color, by people of color, and everybody else. My name is Luz Maria Frias, and I am the president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis. We have a couple of new voices with us today because we have Anthony Galloway out, sitting out today, and Halid Lee, neither of which could join us, but we've got some incredible other folks ready to jump in with us. So with that, I think we'll welcome folks.
I'm Don Eubanks, Associate Professor in Social Work at Metropolitan State University and Cultural Consultant.
So I'm Akua Ellis, Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the Greater Twin Cities United Way.
And it's Joe Erickson. I'm a producer for NPR. And this is my very first time in the hot seat. And
we're loving it because
hot.
We've been trying to persuade you.
We've been trying to get you here.
Yeah, so we're so glad that you're jumping in with us. So a lot has happened in the last week or so and continues to happen almost daily. So there's much to talk about and a few minutes to kind of cover it all. So we'll just jump in. I think top of mind, of course, is the release of the video footage, the body cam footage that was released regarding the Thurman Blevins shooting here in Minneapolis. And maybe we go around and just share what each other's thoughts were in reaction to that video and since then, coming a few days after that. And then I thought I'd share an example, a case that's also local within the last month of how things were handled substantially differently and how that might influence how people understand the dynamics of what's going on in reaction to the release of the footage and the county attorney in Hennepin County deciding not to charge the two officers. What's on your mind?
Well, when I initially saw the video, I witnessed the cop as they were pulling up. And you see who a young man sitting on a curb next to a woman in a baby carriage. And this police officer immediately hops out of his car with his gun drawn, hollering, ordering this person to, I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was immediate. It was like, this guy's just sitting there on the street. He could have just hopped out of his car and walked up and started a conversation to find out what's going on. But that's not how this was approached. I know that there was a call that came in about somebody shooting a gun in the air or shooting a gun in the ground, but that doesn't warrant just jumping out with a gun, assuming, I mean, and I think that that's where for us as people of color, it's this assumption that we're guilty.
So there was what I'm also maybe reading into your statement there, Don, is that there was a predisposition at an escalated state of mind, if you will, by the police rather than de-escalating and just starting a conversation. Like,
just
have you
exactly
asking the questions?
Yeah.
Did you hear any bullets? Did you hear any sound? I mean, just asking questions rather than assuming that the guilt is there and that he is the person
exactly
at issue.
No assessment of the situation other than just driving up, seeing this gentleman and just assuming that he was a bad guy. That was the total reaction of this officer hopping out with his gun drawn. And then Blevins takes off and starts running. And, you know, I know with the video, it's very hard to see, but in my mind, it didn't matter if he still had a gun in his pocket or not. He was running away. He wasn't posing a threat. Obviously, he was scared for his life. And as he turns down the alley, and I think this is where, you know, I'm hearing Mike Freeman and everything else and everyone else kind of give explanations for what they saw. I mean, I've even heard comments that he apparently pulled his gun out again and fired again. I didn't see that. I just saw a black man running down the alley, and I could hear him screaming, "Don't shoot me, don't shoot me." And then they opened fire and killed him. And so, I mean, for me, it was shocking. What I witnessed was two white police officers running down a young black male. And I'm still trying to figure out why. You know, I mean, we'll never know if he was even the one who supposedly shot the gun in the air or shot the gun in the ground. I mean, which is what initiated the initial phone call. But we'll never know that.
I was about to say, when I saw the video, now the first part of the video took place and it was just talking. It was the officers who had just arrived and they hadn't put on their body cam. So it was a dark picture and you just heard their voices. And they said, "Hey, I see a gun. I see some alcohol and I see some guns." And they did. They rushed out. And like what you said, they didn't assess. Could have taken a breath and assessed the situation and looked at what they could have done. I don't think they actually looked at their own training and said, "Hey, there are these scenarios, we can explore them." They just instantly took off. But I am not a police officer, and it's easier for us to say, "Hey, he did have a weapon." It's harder to say, "Hey, I feel confident that the police were overreacting." But I do feel that lethal force and how it ended up with a person killed is where I think the questions are.
Yeah. Well, what's your take? I mean, what was your reaction, Akua?
So I didn't watch it.
Intentional. We should disclose that the two of you identify as
African American, for sure.
Joe?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, just because you're new on the show, and so that folks have that clarity.
Yes. Yeah, so I saw that it was released, and have made an intentional effort not to watch the video for two reasons. One is for the preservation of my spirit, particularly as the mother of a black boy. I've seen it happen too many times. I've witnessed it too many times. And it is taxing in ways that I'm not always able to articulate. And so out of the desire to preserve my spirit and my fight, I chose not to watch it. The second reason I immediately thought about his family. So I'm not from the Twin Cities. I'm from the Quad Cities in Iowa. And I say that because I'm from Davenport, Iowa, and it's right across the river from Rock Island, Illinois, very similar to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I had a cousin shot dead by a Rock Island officer as he was walking from Davenport on the bridge. And
how old were you then?
I was an adult. I lived here. Okay. He suffered from schizophrenia, something that wasn't discovered by my family until his third tour in the penitentiary. Had gone off his meds and had a break, and hit someone at a soup kitchen. And so the folks who were operating the soup kitchen called the police, and he was walking. It was near the river, so he was walking across the bridge, was approached by a Davenport officer who tried to tase him. He was a great big guy, was not stunned by the taser, removed the prongs, and then attacked the officer. And as I mentioned, was, you know, profoundly mentally ill. An officer answering the call for help coming from Rock Island actually shot him and killed him. And it was all on YouTube, played over over and over again, and provided the opportunity to question my cousin's humanity. Mm. And so I've watched enough of these videos that I know that it profoundly impacts the way I parent my son. It complicates my respect for and appreciation for law enforcement, and it impacts my spirit because, you know, the conversation had been over the years, you know, he said, she said, often he said, and we would see officers, you know, walk away without any sort of
accountability
for killing our Black men. And then we thought, oh, but now there's proof, there's footage. And we've watched time and time again that that doesn't necessarily mean that folks can't be gunned down with impunity. Yeah. And so I've made a conscious decision not to watch it. And as a result, you know, haven't weighed in, but my consistent prayers and thoughts are with that family for what they must be experiencing with so many unanswered questions. And again, every time an unarmed, well, I won't even say unarmed, anytime a police-involved shooting involves a Black man, there is an immediate call to dehumanize that individual. And it's incredibly frustrating.
So you are in a place of trauma that when we hear about these shootings of our community members, we know that trauma exists in various forms, mm-hmm. And yours is one that has a profound deepness to it because of a family member who's mm-hmm. been killed. And I would venture to say, without putting words in your mouth, that you are re-traumatized every single time there's another killing of a member of our community, irrespective of where that person might live, because of the fact that your own cousin was killed.
I would say that is definitely that is part of it, but I think it's more because I have a brown son.
Well, and your husband is still...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
I've known you now for a number of years, and your husband is also someone within an age, if you will.
Right.
I mean, not that mm-hmm. there's ever, mm-hmm. you know, a perfect age, mm-hmm. But one who could easily, be in a similar situation.
Right. And so I love and care for my husband, but I am not charged with protecting him the way I am my son. And feeling powerless to do so is incredibly disheartening.
Well, let me introduce a set of circumstances and facts, and these are facts, so this is not a hypothetical, that I think we should engage in a conversation to just really juxtapose what's happened not only with Thurman Blevins, you know, because it's so recent in our memory, but the dozens, if not hundreds of other examples we've seen in the last couple of years. So I am reading from a report. So it's actually a report on KSTP.com, dated July 19th, where a suspect, Dustin Allen Beiderbecke of South St. Paul, had been apprehended. And the press conference that was held, that's the basis for this report, indicates that police had been called because of a missing person who had returned home, you know, returned to the place where they were, he was missing from. The officers arrived on the scene, and that suspect appeared to sound distraught. An altercation ensued, and the suspect reportedly obtained a shotgun and began shooting at the officers.
Mm.
So let's be clear. This is factual. KSTP, July 19th. The officers are faced, you know, here with this suspect, Dustin Allen Beiderbecke, shooting at the two officers, actually shoots each officer, one in the shoulder, one in the leg. The police chief says at this conference, the officers returned the fire, but the suspect was not harmed. The gun, and I'm quoting, the gun was eventually dropped and the suspect was taken into custody. Okay. The building where the suspect lives, the police had responded 62 times this year alone on police calls.
So there's a history.
There's a definite history of there being problems. And I should clarify for our listeners that Dustin Allen Beiderbecke is white. So, you know, when we talk about how Thurman Blevins was a threat because he had a gun, let's juxtapose that with this Dustin Allen Beiderbecke. Thurman was running away from the police. Dustin is looking at the police.
Now, he's not looking at the police. Well, he's shooting the police.
He's facing the police, okay? He's not running. Dustin's got a shotgun, and I'm not an armament, you know, specialist, but a shotgun is a lot bigger than a gun, right? And so are the bullets that come out of it. So Dustin is able to shoot the police officers and actually injure both officers. And again, quoting from the press conference, the gun was eventually dropped, and then the suspect was apprehended. So let's just all kind of let this sit in, and all within proximity, South St. Paul, so Minnesota, we're not talking about some other place, within the last month, July 19th, within weeks of the killing of Thurman Blevins. So a lot of questions, right? So are the South St. Paul police officers more apt at de-escalation? Are they better trained? Are they trained differently? Is it different because of a whole lot of other circumstances? What does this look like? And why hasn't there been someone else drawing this distinction or this correlation between these two shootings that happened in such close proximity within, you know, a quick drive from one city to another, and compare that? I mean, are we, you know, where's the media outlet's responsibility to begin to draw those connections as well?
When I listen to Akua's personal history, it moves me when someone can talk so powerfully about their experience, but also show you that this is an experience that can happen to people of color, whether you are in a good position or a bad position. It's everywhere. And I think we are just in a state where we're just traumatized by just how prevalent this continues. We just, as you say, with this example, we had two examples. A young black man whose incident ended up with him being fatally shot by police, and an incident with a white person that ended up in the way that we all would like all incidents to end up. So I can't conclude anything, but for us, it's for people of color, it's disappointing that we can never feel confident that the police will police in a fair way.
Well, so to the question that Lou's raised, I'd be curious to know if you think it would make a difference if the discrepancy in approach, we'll call it, were highlighted by media. You know, even as you were reading the story, what I heard was some sort of recognition of the experience of the shooter, like what he was feeling. He was distraught. Mm-hmm. I've not seen any sort of story about the Blevins incident that talked about how he might have been feeling. You know,
like again, going to humanize him, as to your
humanizing. Point there, yeah. That's exactly right. I think You know, there are a couple other topics that we were discussing before starting that, to me, at the heart of all of this is a willingness to acknowledge one another's humanity, like as just like a baseline. You know, and I think media has a strong role in doing that.
I believe it is incumbent upon someone who's a journalist, and I you know, whom, in whatever media source there is, whether it's TV or radio or newspaper for that matter, you are taught, it's my understanding, to be a critical thinker, right? And to be impartial. So asking questions and not taking at face value that what happened in the Thurman Blevins case, that's an absolute only way of doing it that way, and that there are no other similarly situated circumstances that have yielded a different outcome. So asking those probative questions is say, okay, so police, you're saying he held a gun, you were afraid for life, which is always the standard now, is all you have to say is I fear for my life, and then
it's almost as
lethal.
As if they're coached
to
give that response.
To ask, you know, the media should ask responsibly. So police union president, you're saying lethal force is justified because this guy had a gun. So let's test that. Does that hold true in all these other cases, and begin to bring those other circumstances and examples to bear so that us as listeners or consumers of the news media begin to question. We are in a society where analytical thinking is so important, particularly now when you've got this fake news that you as a listener can't
often discern.
Right. You can't ingest everything for absolute face value and not question it. And you should be able to ask these questions. And why are the journalists not doing that on a, you know, I'll just say on this basis, you know, I won't paint with the broad brush, but it really, I'm not a journalist. It didn't take me but a hot second to find this, you know, by doing a little bit of you know, searching. It's not that hard to be a critical thinker and to ask the questions and to hold folks accountable.
You know, I was there was a recent study that was just released within the past couple weeks, and I don't remember the name of the researchers or where exactly they did this, but they were, the question was looking at media and how they covered these events and how media portrayed the individuals in the news coverage. And statistically, with all the reports that they looked at throughout the country, it statistically broke down with exactly with what you were saying, that when the coverage was on a person of color, the remarks tended to dehumanize that individual, versus when the coverage was on an American. and we know what we mean when we say an American. So the study itself was pointing out the racial bias that's involved with media and how they cover these stories. You know, my heart is really heavy listening to your story. You know, my wife, unfortunately, has to put up with me every evening. And I don't know why I do this every evening, but every evening I'll watch the news. And sometimes even I have to ask myself why. Because I just react to what I'm hearing that comes out of the announcers' mouths as they're reading their news lines. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and with the Blevins coverage, It was so negative. It was already he was guilty. Not one of those channels covered or said anything about him as a human being, what kind of young man he was like. Nothing. It did nothing to humanize him. And, you know, the comment by the president of the Minneapolis Police Association continues this dehumanization in terms of, you know, with everything that he saw, these police officers were fully justified because Blevins was fair game. I mean, who uses language like that? It's like hunting an animal, right? Well, I mean, and we have a history of that from ever since they brought us over on the boats and as slaves, and when we tried to escape, they hunted us down as like animals. We were fair game. But to hear that, you know, to hear someone,
his heart revealed.
Exactly. I mean, and we know exactly where that's coming from. It just continues. You know, I've been with this group in Roseville as a result of the Philando Castile shooting. Mm-hmm. And we're still dealing with the repercussions of that. And, you know, now we have this, we have Blevins, and it won't stop. On top of, you know, it's, you know, I think our last conversation, we were talking about the trauma that hits us with every one of these incidences. It's like, you know, I also have a son. I have a daughter. You know, I haven't seen much happening with females, thank God.
Sandra Bland.
True.
Nia.
Not as many.
Yeah.
But I do have a son, right? Mm-hmm. And we all have had that conversation mm-hmm. with our children mm-hmm. where we have to tell them how they have to act in case they get stopped by police. So, and he's had that experience twice. Mm.
So the other element of this is a lot of folks in mainstream media and communities blaming Thurman Blevins for running.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I want to talk to that and share with you yet something else. Dated September 20th, 2016. This is a case that was decided by the Massachusetts Supreme Court. The court noted that state law gives individuals the right to not speak to police and even walk away if they aren't charged with anything. Now, this is a gentleman. It was three African-American men who were stopped on a suspicion of having a gun. The court said that when an individual does flee, the action doesn't necessarily mean the person is guilty. And when it comes to black men, the Boston Police Department and ACLU reports documenting a pattern of racial profiling of black men in the city of Boston must be taken into consideration. I'm sorry, I said Boston Police, it was Boston Public Defender. Reports documenting a pattern of racial profiling of black men in the city of Boston must be taken into consideration, meaning that if you're fleeing and you're running, it's because you know that you're being profiled and you fear for your life. So rather than presuming that Thurman Blevins was running because he was guilty, why isn't a discussion being had about he feared for his life? And in fact, when he was running and on the body cam video, he is saying, "Don't shoot me." He is fearing for his life. He's not asserting some combative stance. And when you look at this Supreme Court decision from Massachusetts that happened nearly 2 years ago, why are we hearing about that when analysts are talking about, right? So again, why are we not thinking critically to begin to shape the narrative differently so that we begin to see more than one side of what the reporting looks like?
Well, not just that, but what was he guilty of? What was
Thurman Blevins?
Yes. What was Thurman Blevins guilty of? I mean, so there's this presumption that he was guilty. Guilty of what? Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know if he was the one who, and if he did shoot the gun in the air, so that there might be a Minneapolis City charter or something somewhere that says you're not supposed to discharge a gun in city limits. And what is that, a misdemeanor, if anything? Or, I mean, it's a very petty, right? So even if he was guilty of that, doesn't mean he dies. And I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, it's and you know, hats off to Massachusetts that they had the ability to be able to see that, because those same disparities exist here in the Twin Cities, not just in police stops, but in every aspect of our lives, from housing to education to employment to, you know, just whatever demographic you want to put up there. There is a disparity that exists for people of color in the Twin Cities.
As I say, we've quickly become, rather than the state of 10,000 lakes, but the state of 10,000 disparities.
Mm.
Because when you think about disparities, there was a report back in 2006, Mind the Gap, that was issued, mm-hmm. that really yes. began to push this issue of disparities onto kind of the public's eye. And fast forward, so 2006, 2018, 12 years later, and there are many more disparities that have mm-hmm. been unearthed since then. And not only are those are there more disparities, but the disparities we began with are worse than they were 12 years ago. So I often, when I'm out speaking, will begin with that statement mm-hmm. of, you know, we've quickly become the land of 10,000 disparities.
You know, and it's not by accident, right? You know, much of what we're observing is the result of policies which are creating the results. They're perhaps not intentionally designed to create, but nonetheless are creating those unintended consequences in some instances. Something that I was excited to share with the group is the upcoming release of the Governor's Housing Task Force on Housing report, because when you talk about disparities, we're all as a state struggling with the lack of, like, there's just not enough units of housing, period. Despite what we see in these high rises going up across the state, as co-chair of the task force and as part of that work, we went all over the state to better understand what the circumstance was. And what we found was that in general, there's just a shortage of units. And when you have a shortage of units, there's an increase in demand, and an increase in demand yields an increase in price. And when you, to bring it back home, think about the impact of that juxtaposed against income inequality, disparities in employment, you start to understand why there's an incredible overrepresentation of people of color, and in particular, Black folks who are experiencing homelessness and housing instability. And so I'm really excited about the report, and would urge folks to go and take a look at it on the Governor's Housing Task Force website, www.housingtaskforce.com.
And I want to say, you're not saying it, but you co-chaired?
I did co-chair it with Jean Crane, president of Bremer Financial. And so but what I'm most proud of is the fact that it was informed by folks, not just in the metro, but across the state. And the recommendations that are within that report reflect what we heard in those stories. It reflects the experiences, the hopes, the dreams, the challenges of folks who are struggling to make ends meet. And there's a role for all of us, because the housing advocacy space is one that is still pretty homogenous. And oftentimes those folks who are directly impacted by the challenge are not a part of arriving at the solutions and advocating for those. So I want to call the listeners to be a part of that solution. And there are lots of opportunities to do that, especially now during election season. You know, you got folks knocking on your door looking for your vote. Ask them where they are on housing.
When we talk about where you're talking about the disparities, one way to also get that message across and what you're stating, Akua, at the beginning, which is the disparities are symptoms of the systemic barriers.
That's exactly right.
And so when we look at what disparities are, you need to get to the systemic barriers that are manifesting themselves in mm-hmm. the way of a disparity. Mm-hmm. And once you identify what those systemic barriers are, then we know that we need systems change mm-hmm. in order to rectify that. Mm-hmm. In an area such as housing, as you noted, it's so much more complex, because in order to afford to live anywhere, mm-hmm. you need to have a whole host of things kind of line up, if mm-hmm. you will. You need the proper credit, right? You need employment to be able to afford it. And, and the guideline that I'm familiar with, and you can correct me if it's changed, is that your 30% of your income is what should be allotted for housing, right? And if it's even more than that, then you've got a problem in terms of being able to meet your other basic needs in terms of transportation and food and clothing and so on and so forth. And then you've got the ability just to have a livable wage that allows you to afford that. And then the issue becomes even deeper when you're talking about systemic unemployment or low-wage jobs. I often think about how in the retail industry and in the food industry, you have workers who are asking to work full-time, but they're not provided with full-time hours for a variety of reasons. The end result is that you think you're going to be scheduled for 40 hours and you're working 4 hours a week without any type of control over that. And I'll put my daughter's business out there, so to speak, this summer. I mean, she actually had two jobs. On paper, she had two jobs working in retail. And the most she was able ever to get was under 20 hours, usually 16 hours. And in fact, the last...
Total
per week. Wow. And the last 3 weeks, she averaged 4 hours 1 week, 0 hours each of the last week and this week. And she would call the manager and try to get hours. And, you know, there was a spiel about, oh, you know, we're just, we just have too many people or we're redistributing hours. Luckily, she doesn't have the living expenses that someone would, you know, independently. She's a college kid, you know, and trying to make money over the summer. And we are able to provide for her housing and food and transportation. But it is not lost upon me how devastating that equation would be in a family who is trying to maintain a household for themselves or their children or their family.
You know, one thing that you mentioned on the credit was like a big aha for me in listening to. We had a community forum in Minneapolis, and I did not realize that for each time you apply for an apartment, they're doing a check on your credit, and it's a hard hit. So if you're going and applying to multiple places because there's, you know, not a ton of opportunity, each time you're told no, not only do you lose that housing opportunity, but your likelihood of being a viable candidate for the next housing opportunity is decreased. So it's just like this.
Yeah, your credit score keeps getting lower.
Your credit score goes down, so it's harder for you to find an apartment and build your credit for home ownership.
I was about to say, is the task force only looking at affordable housing, or is it also looking at other aspects of housing when it comes to people of color? They are not doing well when it comes to applying for mortgages. In my own case, if I was to apply for a housing as a Black woman, even though my husband, bless you, Rich, you do not earn anything like I do. He's a wonderful musician, but it's infrequent to how much he earns. So the bank actually took my credit and they took my details. And he was the front person. So he went out there and he presented us as we went to the mortgage. I was never in a meeting. I didn't see anyone. He was the front person. He goes in there. He negotiates as a white Minnesotan with the name of Erickson. Good Swedish name. Not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Your wife is doing very well. She works at NPR. We got tick, tick, tick. You've got that mortgage straight ahead. Whereas my girlfriend, whose husband is also African-American, she was turned down. They were turned down 3 or 4 times. They had to, they didn't get the house that they wanted. They were given higher rates of interest. It was an ordeal. And I learned from their case, and I put my husband forward, and it was a different situations.
So those are the systemic barriers. Exactly. Those are exactly the systemic barriers.
And my story is no different. I mean, the first house we bought, you've met my wife, and she's German and Dutch, right? Can't blonde, blue hair, can't get any whiter than that. I never showed up. You know, we bought our first home in Como neighborhood.
That's where I am now.
And I never showed up until we signed the papers. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you know, it plays out like that. The second house, however, there was a friend of mine that was in that industry that I was able to go to and secure a mortgage. And so we didn't quite have to do that again the second time. Only because I was friends mm-hmm. with this guy. Otherwise, you know, and my own father who, and I've mentioned this before, my own father who, fought World War II, received a Purple Heart, was in the Pacific, he was in the Navy. But he, as well as all the rest of the African-American servicemen who returned after World War II, were denied access to the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. The GI Bill is what educated white servicemen and bought their homes with the creations of all the suburbs. And if a family of color, particularly African-American, were able to afford new housing in the new suburbs that were springing up during that time period after the war, they were denied mm-hmm. The ability to buy because of a federal policy that was written that suggested that that selling a home to a Negro would devalue the surrounding homes.
Redlining.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and so, I mean, so we have this whole well-documented history of systemic racism and discrimination that has helped create the neighborhoods that we currently have mm-hmm. in the Twin Cities. I mean, I remember specifically growing up where you know, there were only certain pockets in the Twin Cities where we could mm-hmm. live, where we
covenants.
Were allowed to live. Mm-hmm. And those covenants, you mm-hmm. know, the covenants that exist in the Twin Cities, mm-hmm.
They mirror current housing patterns.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, Dr. Sam Myers, who's at the University of Minnesota and the Humphrey Institute, has done a wealth of research on this, and he's nationally known, and I would even venture to guess that he's internationally known for this. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this redlining and patterns. He also ties it to the wealth gap and
mm-hmm.
The fact that it's generational wealth that is passed down from one family to another by way of a home that then it's kept in the family, and that's the capital, if you will, that goes from generation to generation. So it goes deeper into the fact that we've got generations of African-American families and families of color who are unable to create that generational wealth because of the redlining mm-hmm. practices as well. So again, a deeper conversation. Mm-hmm. I know that we're probably coming up on time here, but I didn't want to close off before sharing one other piece of news that's on my mind, and it was on my mind coming in, which is we learned this afternoon through the Washington Post that a child who has been part of the administration's detention and separation of families has died. And the child, I'll quote from the Post here, says, the child died following her stay at an ICE detention center as a result of possible negligent care, and a respiratory illness she contracted from one of the other children. The events took place in Dilley Family Detention Center in South Texas. So when we think about that, you know, there's so much that's wrong with that. And we covered a large part of about just the separation of families in our previous segment. But the part that's been bothering me most, even before reading this headline, was the fact that as the courts have ordered the administration and the ICE department in particular to reunify families. There are about 700 families or so, which is, I think, a number that I keep hearing over and over, that the government, our government, has deemed ineligible for reunification with their family. And the basis for the ineligibility of reunification is that their parents have a criminal history of some sort, a criminal background. So, cognitive dissonance, right? So we've got a government saying that they are somehow in a position to assess a child's welfare based on the family having a conviction or not. And mind you, this conviction wasn't stopping them from the child being with the family previously, when, you know, by virtue of the fact that they came into the country seeking the asylum at that point. So there's one dissonance there, right? And then the other part of it is that the government, our government, has chosen to also administer psychotropic drugs on these children while in detention, which is another part of what the news media is covering in the last week or two, without their consent, without their knowledge, without the parents' knowledge. But somehow the government believes that to be in the best interest of the child, which is a standard in law in terms of being in the best interest of the child. And that if all of that weren't bad enough and horrific enough, that now we have a child, a toddler, we don't know the exact age just yet at this time, or name of the family, or whether the parents are nearby, or whether they've been, and have been, or maybe they're back, they've been deported to their home country. But this is 2018. How is this happening in our country? And that we as Americans, you know, going back to your point, Akua, about humanizing people.
Yes.
It just, I'm sorry, I know we're coming to an end, but I just can't stop thinking about Blevins. And the fact that, you know, he was a son, he was a father, he was a brother, he probably was an uncle. You knew he had a lot of cousins.
He had a very prominent family.
He was probably employed. He was a former student. I mean, you know, he was all these things.
He was a person.
And we lost another member of our community to violence. It's that side of the story that we never hear locally. Very seldom do we hear it nationally. And with this story now, with this child passing away while being detained, this all ties together, the entire climate. I'm incredibly blown away how this climate just has gotten so heavy since the election of our 45th president. And it's like a daily assault. And it's just this heaviness that, you know, and that just seems to be an onslaught day in and day out.
I heard the president of the NAACP, Leslie Baddoo.
Minneapolis NAACP.
Yeah, she, I guess, summed it up. She said that yet another killing, and it seems like no one actually hears what the community is saying. You keep on saying the same things all the time, but no one's really listening. And she wanted to make Thurman Blevins a person. She wanted to make people feel that he was a person. Regardless of what was going on, he was a person who should be treated as any other human being. And I guess that we dehumanize people to such a degree that it makes it easier for people to palate that this incident happened, turn the page, something else happens tomorrow, turn the page. We are not moved anymore by anything. And that's a disappointment.
A part of me wonders if it is not a defense mechanism in some way. That if I acknowledge another's humanity, I am bound to respond accordingly. And for multiple reasons, don't wish to be in that position, don't wish to feel compelled to respond.
So this has been another segment of Counter Stories, and we've covered a lot. And when we think about just what's going on in the community locally and nationally, I think it's just incumbent upon us to continue to be well-informed, to continue to ask questions, and do so in a way that really challenges a narrative that is given to us, without any sort of analytical type of assessment. And then also just ask ourselves, where do we fit in terms of action? Where do we fit in this equation? What's our moral responsibility for ourselves to act on what is happening? We know we're in an election year. We know that November 14th in Minnesota is a primary for many candidates. And as you said, Akua, it's a good time to ask people where they stand, whether it's on housing or any other issues that are manifesting themselves in the disparities. Mm-hmm. And then from a human rights point of view, asking where they stand on some basic human rights issues where someone's assertion of a human right doesn't mean I have less of a human right.
That's right.
It is not a finite sort. By virtue of the fact that we all are living and walking this earth, we are humans, and therefore we have an innate right as a human right. We don't have to earn it in terms of color of your skin or income or education level. We all have basic human rights, and we should remember that once in a while. With that, this has been Counter Stories. Luz Maria Frias.
Don Eubanks.
Akua Ellis.
And Joe Erickson.
We'll see you next time.